You know, ordinarily, it would be a lot easier to tell the story of something that has happened to a child than to tell the story of something that has happened to an adult. Telling the story of a child who's lost their first tooth. Telling the story of a child's first bike ride and the like. That is so much more fascinating and interesting and relatable than telling the story of one's first tax exemption or one's first refinancing on a house. So by extension, when you come to this text about Jesus as a child, you would think, well, that's got to be fairly straightforward. It's got to be easier to preach about Jesus the child than Jesus the adult. Well, I'm here to say it is infinitely more difficult, I have found, to preach this text, at least to preach it aright, and to focus on some of the complex theology that is just beneath the radar, or at least is beneath the radar, if you just give this text a cursory reading. You see, in today's text, we're going to read this statement. Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Let me ask you a thinking question. Let's get the brains moving here this morning. How in the world does an immutable, unchanging God increase in anything? If God isn't unchanging, if God's immutable, and if Jesus is God, how in the world does this Jesus increase? How does he grow in stature? How does he grow in his understanding? Is this not God we're talking about? Then how does he increase? How does he increase in wisdom, as Scripture says? Does that mean that he encountered knowledge that he didn't previously know? And if he didn't previously know it, what does that say about his omniscience? Right? This is an omniscient God, an all-knowing God. So how in the world did he increase in knowledge? I want you to think on that. Now, we're obviously going to labor on this point to some length here in this morning's sermon, but I say all this at the outset to illustrate to you that this text is not as simple as a first read might make it seem. The minute that Luke says that Jesus increased or grew in wisdom, in one sense, this is an understandable way of saying that any child is developing. If you were to say that about Bob or Frank or Stu or Fran, that wouldn't be a problem. They increased in maturity and understanding and the like, you don't bat an eye. But this is not Frank or Stu or Bob or Fran. This is Jesus. How did he increase? How do you reconcile all this? If I've just wrinkled your brain for a moment, how do you reconcile that wrinkling? How do you reconcile this? Can these questions even be reconciled? Well, the short answer and the good news is yes. Theologians have long understood that these issues can be reconciled, but it requires one to draw some very careful parameters, around what you might call the divine and human natures of Jesus Christ. It requires us to have some very careful definitions regarding the human and the divine natures of Christ. Now, it's not easy. I wish I could say it was. And the bones of more heretics lay in this ditch than just about any other when it comes to the human and the divine natures of Jesus Christ. Even the Apostle Paul stopped short to some extent. And he said, look, there is a mystery. There's a mystery in all this. In 1 Timothy 3, he says, great indeed, we confess, is the mystery of godliness. He was manifested in the flesh. In other words, even the Apostle Paul, when it came to the incarnation, it's like he threw out his arms and he said, look, this is deep stuff. The mountain we are gazing upon is higher than our eyes can see. Great is the mystery we confess that he was manifested in the flesh. Now, if aspects of the incarnation were mysterious to Paul, of all people, they're probably going to remain mysterious to us. Nevertheless, we have to look at today's passage with regards to Christ's early life and consider it in light of this doctrine, in light of the doctrine of the incarnation. And as we go through this text, as we go through verses 41 through 52, we may need to take some pit stops along the way in order to apply the theology of the incarnation to what we are seeing in this passage regarding Christ's youth. All right, if you would, let's look at verses 41 and 42, and then we'll work our way through the text. Verse 41. His parents, meaning Christ's parents, went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. All right. Do you remember what the Passover is? Let's start there. Well, the Passover was that great event during the life and times of Moses, during which the angel of death came and passed over the Israelites' homes, while at the same time marking for death those whose doorposts were not marked by the blood of the Lamb. The firstborn sons of the Egyptians were slaughtered on this night. This Passover feast was remembered regularly, consistently over the centuries, and people reflected back and they recalled what God did in times past. past. And this always caused them to look forward to what he would yet do. The lamb's blood on the doorpost was always meant to look forward to the lamb's blood on Calvary, the perfect Lamb of God. So the law of Moses said that adult males should travel to Jerusalem to celebrate this feast by which Passover was remembered. In verse 42, the whole family is going to Jerusalem. It's like a road trip. The whole family is going to Jerusalem to do just that. Okay, verses 43 through 45. Now when they had finished the days, as they returned, the boy Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem. And Joseph and his mother did not know it. But, supposing him to have been in the company, they went a day's journey, and they sought him among their relatives and their acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem, seeking him. Okay. How long did the Passover last? How long did this celebration last? Well, when verse 43 says that they stayed, or they finished the days, this implies that they stayed for all 7 days. And during that time, they probably stayed with friends or families or distant relatives and so forth in the city. However, when this feast wraps up at the end of these days, as we see in verse 43, when the feast wrapped up, verse 44 says that they headed home. They went back home and they traveled about a day's journey towards their home when they discovered that young Jesus was not with them. The young Jesus was not in their midst. Now this begs two questions immediately. First of all, as a parent, you say, oh my goodness, what is going on here? It makes us wonder, how in the world do these parents, I mean, this is Joseph and Mary, right? These are, you know, two of the more finer examples of parenthood in all of Scripture. How in the world did Joseph and Mary manage to leave Jesus behind? It sounds like the plot of a Home Alone movie. It sounds like some derelict action on behalf of his parents here. How did this happen? So that's the first question we might have. Well, the short answer, the commonly understood answer to this is that Jesus and his family were part of a larger group. They were part of a caravan that was heading home. And as they went north, they probably assumed that Jesus was with them. It would have been reasonable for this to assume amidst such a large crowd, of which there was many relatives and the like. They simply thought that Jesus was hanging out with another part of the family, with other friends. The fact that he was not in their field of vision did not indicate that he was lost. So this doesn't suggest bad parenting. It just is probably a common event for parents in this day. Now, secondly, the second question that we might have here. When verse 43 says that Jesus stayed behind or remained behind or lingered in Jerusalem, was this intentional? What went on here? Well, the answer to that is less clear. It's less clear from this text. But let me submit this. On a human level, we have to remember, there's like 3 million people in Jerusalem. It is not hard to imagine people getting separated with all the coming and going that was going on in this time and in this place. It's very possible, even likely, some might think, that this separation was an accident brought on by the sheer hordes of the crowds that were around. At the same time, as I think that's possible, they just got separated, I think it's equally possible that Jesus was drawn to the voice of his Father as it was read and studied in the temple courts. It's possible that young Jesus felt compelled to be as close to God the Father as he possibly could, which in earthly terms meant going to the temple. Going to the temple. It does not necessarily imply sin or disobedience here. In fact, we know it doesn't imply sin. In any case, verse 45 suggests that Joseph and Mary, they don't know what's going on, so they return to Jerusalem and they begin to look for their son. Now, where? Where did they look and when did they look there? Well, let's look at verses 46 and 47. Verse 46. Now, so it was that after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and his answers. All right, verse 46 says that after Joseph and Mary returned to Jerusalem, how many days did it take them to find Jesus? It took them 3 days. What does that tell you as a parent? It either tells you that Jesus really got himself lost, or you're looking in the wrong place. 3 days. You know, what this suggests is that the temple is not the first place they looked. It's not the first place they went to. You know, if you and I who are parents, if you lose a child in a big city or perhaps in a suburban shopping district, you're probably going to go looking at McDonald's. I don't know. You're going to go looking at arcades and the like. You're probably going to look in these sorts of places to look for a child, to look for a youth above and beyond going into local churches. You're probably going to go in these sorts of places. You might go looking at the houses of friends, relatives, and the like. There's probably any number of places that you might look to find a child that you've lost. And in Joseph and Mary's case, they probably went to the relatives. They went to house to house. to friends. They looked at, you know, the first century equivalent of the arcades and the like. They thought they might find Jesus in such a common place. Apparently, it was only after 3 days that they tried the temple, or at least this portion of the temple where Christ was. And when they went to the temple, there he was, sitting right in the midst of the teachers. And at that point, even Jesus himself, I think, was a little surprised that they didn't start their search in the temple. I think he was a little surprised they didn't start there, because what did he ask him? He said, "Didn't you know that I would be about my Father's business?" In a sense, the implication is, where did you think I was going to be? Didn't you know that I was going to be about my Father's business? You can almost hear his parents saying, you know, we looked at Uncle Bob's and we looked at this place and this place and this place. And it's almost like Jesus says, there was really only one place I was going to be. It was going to be about my Father's business. You know, as a short aside, let me take one of those pit stops I mentioned earlier. Now, obviously, Jesus was a unique child. There's no doubt about that. But nevertheless, I think that this passage gives us a window into the high view that God places on family worship, on children and their parents sitting together and sitting, so to speak, at the feet of God and His Word. You who are parents and you who are children, don't ever think that children can't or shouldn't participate in the corporate life of the body. If ever there's a biblical precedent for this, it's right here. It's this picture of young Jesus, just 12 years old, sitting, learning, asking questions in the midst of his elders, the adults, the leaders in the temple. There's a biblical precedent for this that we're wise not to ignore. Now, with that said, something that was unique to Jesus that didn't apply to every other kid on the street here, something that was certainly unique to Jesus, something that no child before or since has ever emulated or shared, was that the nature of his questions, when he asked them, the nature of his questions and the understanding of his answers, it was so advanced that it astonished, not just startled, not just surprised, but astonished those who heard. Now, why was that? Why was that the case? Why was Jesus so advanced as to shock or astonish those in the temple? Well, on the one hand, we can answer in our own mind's eye. We say, well, he's God. You know, of course he was going to be astonishing and the like. This is God in the flesh. So, of course, we think that that implies certain advantages in his understanding of theology. However, although I think that that's true, let me suggest something additional for you to consider. In theology, we have a term, a phrase. It's called the noetic effect of sin. Show of hands, how many people have heard that phrase before? Okay, got a few. The noetic effect of sin. Now let me express what this means. We know that our nature is fallen, right? We are inclined to sin. We're inclined to do things we ought not do. We're sinners by nature. Now that sin affects our choices, affects our appetites, affects our attitudes, our total depravity, affects every aspect of mankind. But something that we forget is the degree to which it affects our minds. The noetic effect of sin is this, that our minds, the synapses, the way we connect the dots, the way we work things through, has also been affected by sin to the degree that our minds are corrupted. If you ever wonder why you can have two people looking at the same empirical data points and come to radically different conclusions, there might be a lot of reasons why, but one of the reasons why is because of the noetic effect of sin. You and I think that we got this mental acumen that we're sharp, we're precise, or at least that we can be sharp and precise if we study enough in the life. Well, to some extent, you know, you can be more sharp and precise than the village idiot, but by the same token, you will never have the mind that Christ had here even as a child. Why? Because his mind was not affected by the noetic effect of sin. His mind was not corrupted. There wasn't a thick fog that filled it. Have you ever sat around as you try to process something, as you're trying to remember something that you heard just like last week, let alone 10 minutes ago, and you can't draw it to mind? Why do you think that happens? The noetic effect of sin. There is a thick blanket on our brain, so to speak. There is a fog that permeates every vessel, every synapse. Even the geniuses, their brains have been affected by the fog of which we speak. But it was not so with Christ. When he sat there amongst the teachers and was asking questions and providing answers, his questions, his answers were completely unaffected by the fog that affected their thinking. And that's part of why they were so astonished. The quickness at which he was able to respond and process things. You and I are far more impaired than we understand. And you know, one of the graces of us getting older and us getting more forgetful and having senior moments and the like is a reminder of this. It's a reminder of the noetic affective sin. It's a reminder that God tells us there's something wrong. It's a gentle way that when you forget things. It's this gentle way of nudging you and reminding you, you aren't the measure of all things. And you need knowledge and input and wisdom from a source greater than yourself. You forget what people said just 10 minutes ago. If I walk out of the room in 10 minutes, you'll forget what tie I'm wearing, right? Right? That's the way we work. It was not so with Jesus. His retention, his memory, his acumen, it was amazing. And it would have caused his peers, no matter what age they were, to stand back in astonishment, let alone the content of what he had to say, let alone the content of his answers. Okay, let's look at verses 48 through 50. So when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you done this to us? Look, your father and I have sought you anxiously." And he said to them, "Why did you seek me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" But they did not understand the statement which he spoke to them. All right, when Joseph and Mary, when they finally find Jesus in the temple, they ask him the understandable question, the question of the hour. "Oh, dear Jesus, where have you been? We've been so anxious. Oh, my goodness, let me hug you. What a relief to find you. What's been going on? We were a day gone. What have you been doing all this time?" You know, they're unpacking all their emotions, are pent up. "You had us worried sick," is what they tell to Jesus. And we who are parents who have misplaced a child even for 10 minutes, you can almost relate, you know, to that wonder of where the child is and the relief of when you find them. Well, in response to this, Jesus is a gracious, loving child, make no mistake, but perhaps with a hug and a smile and so forth, he responds to them. And he says, "Why did you seek me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" Now, we have to be careful in assuming that we can understand what he meant here if his own parents didn't understand what he meant here. Right? Verse 50. They did not understand the statement which he spoke to them. So Jesus' parents didn't totally understand. And they were right there. They were in the catbird seat. They saw and heard the words fresh from the mouth of Jesus. So if they didn't understand it, we have to have some humility and say, "Well, I'm not entirely sure I got this either." So we can't be dogmatic in asserting that we know exactly what Jesus was communicating here. But there are possibilities. And I think there's at least one possibility that makes particular sense. When Jesus said, "Why did he seek me?" Again, he's not asking, you know, why did you even bother looking for me? You know, why did you even worry about me to begin with? I'm a grown boy, you know. That wasn't his response at all. Instead, I think he was asking why they needed to seek him out as if he were lost when they should have known exactly where he was, when they should have known exactly where he would have been in the first place. To Jesus, it's obvious. Where else would I go? I went when I couldn't find my earthly mom and dad, when I couldn't find, you know, Joseph and Mary, when I couldn't find mom and pops. I went to the voice of my father, and the voice of my father is heard most regularly through the reading of his word in the temple. All right, let's look at our final verses now, verses 51 to 52. Then he went down with them and came to Nazareth, and he was subject to them. You know, this is an obedient child, so don't lose the grasp of that. Don't think that this text reflects disobedience. He's subject to them. But his mother kept all these things in her heart, and Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and men. Okay, after finding young Jesus safe and sound in the temple, and their anxiety melts away and they're so relieved, the family, they return home to Nazareth, they're safe and sound, they make their way back, and as they're doing so, Mary, she thinks on these things. Mary, I think, was a contemplative sort, because this isn't the first time that we read about Mary pondering. Remember the words of the angel? She thought on them. For years after, she pondered on these things. And here, who wrote this gospel? It's not a trick question. Luke wrote this gospel. Now, Luke was a historian, right? Luke's a historian. We think he interviewed Mary. We believe that's how we got there. And that's how we would know that she treasured or wondered about these things up in her heart. So in any case, she ponders. And she would continue to ponder what had happened for some time yet to come, right up to and past, including the cross. She would ponder the life and ultimately the ministry of Jesus Christ. She would ponder these things as she fulfilled her very unique role as the earthly mother of a child who had both human and divine natures. Now that said, verse 52 brings us full circle to where we started today. Remember our thinking question at the outset? Verse 52 brings us full circle to where we started when it says that after they got home here, that Jesus continued to increase in wisdom and stature and favor with God and with men. Now if that epilogue belonged to David, If that epilogue belonged to Moses, you wouldn't bat an eye. You would go, all right. To say that someone like David or Moses increased in wisdom and stature and found favor with God and men and the like, that sounds like a good way to describe their lives. And maybe the lives of many people in your own walk, your own family. As God's children, our growth and development is not the most surprising thing in the world. In fact, it's a natural thing because sanctification happens. Growth and maturity and the like, this is natural. But how in the world can these concepts be applied to God Himself? As we said at the outset, we believe God is immutable. That means He doesn't change. The God you go to sleep praying to tonight is the same God you'll wake up to tomorrow. God does not change. Furthermore, we believe that God is omniscient. And that means He knows everything. He knows everything. He declares the end from the beginning. There's no surprises. There's no man behind the curtain. There's nothing that God is unaware of. He knows everything. He's omniscient. And since Jesus is God, Jesus knows everything, right? It goes to follow. With that said, to say here that He increased in wisdom, as if He began to know things that He didn't know before, it strikes at the heart of our understanding of omniscience and immutability. So how do we explain that? How do we reconcile that? Well, with our remaining moments, I want to try. I don't know if we'll get there, but I'm going to give it a shot. And if you'll, excuse me, I need to offer a caveat here at the outset. We need to engage in any conversation that deals with the humanity and the divinity, the natures of Christ. We need to engage in these conversations very carefully and as concisely as we can, because the history of the Christian church, as I said before, it's littered with the bones of heretics that managed to confuse or distort the natures of Christ, the very issues that we're talking about here. The first few centuries of the church, almost every heresy dealt with this exact sort of issue. Now, last week, let me just remind us, last week when we talked about the incarnation, we talked about this idea that the Word became flesh, that Jesus, who is called the Word of God because He's the fullest revelation of God we'll ever have, the Word became flesh and He dwelt among us. Not just a hologram, as we said last week, not just this appearance, not just this stick figure drawing walking around, but He came in the flesh and blood, real flesh and blood. Every bit is similar to what's going through our own veins or what hangs on our own bones. And because He did this, because it was real flesh and blood, when He did this, Jesus, after the incarnation, could now catch a cold, right? He could now sneeze. He could now stub his toe. Jesus could do this, and I'm sure He did this. In Philippians 2, remember the Apostle Paul tried to explain some of this? He summarized Christ's actions in coming down to the manger and taking on human flesh. And he said that when Jesus did this, He laid aside many of what you could say are the prerogatives of His deity. He didn't lay aside the nature of His deity, but some of the prerogatives. In Philippians 2 specifically, we read that He made Himself of no reputation when He came in the likeness of men. Jesus came into this world with a full, complete human nature. He still has it today. Just in case that's a spoiler alert. He still has it today. It hasn't disappeared. When Jesus ascended up in heaven, He didn't discard His body into a ditch. He is still fully God and fully man. He was not a divine hologram. He wasn't 90% of a man, but He was fully man. And it was absolutely necessary that He be so. Remember, this is what we focused on last week. It was absolutely necessary. He had to be a man. He had to be a man because He needed to be an acceptable substitute for we who are men. We are mankind. Jesus Christ had to be a man in order to serve as an acceptable substitute for we who are. He needed to possess our same nature. Now, when He took on flesh and blood, what happened to His deity? What happened to His divinity? Did it just disappear in the bargain? Did it go on a shelf? Maybe if Jesus, like, you take off a cloak and you hang it on the wall and say, well, I won't need you for a while. Is this what happened between the ages of 0 and 33 or so? Well, no, absolutely not. Instead, we believe He remained fully divine, every bit as much as He was fully human. Christ's divinity did not undermine or denigrate His humanity. Neither did His humanity undermine or denigrate His divinity. The Westminster Confession puts it even more clearly. It says this, that both of Christ's natures were whole, perfect, and distinct, yet inseparably joined. Inseparably joined. In any case, because Christ was not just divine, but also fully man, what that meant was that after his birth, as He grew, bones grew, sinew formed, muscle developed. The human brain inside His very human skull was shaped and formed and grew every bit as much as you and I has over the years. And over time, this human mind that he had, which was filled with human blood, human synapses, it became filled with human memories, with human facts and experiences, muscle memory, right? The sort of things that are part and parcel of the human equation were part and parcel to his development, so to speak, the development of his human nature. You know, Christ's human mind as an infant, it was not hardwired to understand Aramaic from the crib. Because if that had been the case, he really wouldn't be fully man. If God had just connected all the dots and the synapses and so forth and pre-programmed this thing, so to speak, if Christ's human mind was hardwired to understand carpentry, then he never would have to learn it from Joseph. But that's not the case. And over time, this human mind was filled with facts and data points and experiences and muscle memory and the like, repetition. And to accept that this is true is not to denigrate Christ's deity, but it is to affirm his humanity. To say that this is true is not to denigrate the divine nature of Christ, it's to affirm his human nature. Now, is it a paradox? Is it a paradox? Because that's been the accusation a lot of folks have. Is it a paradox to be fully God and fully man? Is it a paradox for a God to simultaneously know something, or for Christ to simultaneously know something and yet not know something? Remember any examples of something he didn't know? Well, I can tell you straightforwardly, as a baby, he didn't know how to speak Aramaic. As a one-year-old, he didn't know how to fashion a stool. He didn't know it in the human nature. The divine nature knew the very molecules that made up the wood, that made up the stool. This is complex. This is difficult for us to understand, and yet it is true. And the example that he didn't know all things is, what did he say about the time of his return? He says, only the Father knows that. He says, not even I know the day of my return. And we believe he's saying this with regards to his human understanding, his human knowledge. Analogies are always terrible. They fall 1,000 times short. But let me give you something that can at least give you a frame of reference, if not a point-for-point analogy. If you say that a computer has certain information on it, but that computer's information is shared on two partitions, a C drive and a D drive, now the computer holds the knowledge. When operating a computer, you can draw upon either drive without that data necessarily occupying both drives. Again, this is not form-fitting. It falls ultimately short, far short of what we're trying to explain, but we need sometimes some frames of reference, at least to put this into some form of context that we can understand. That's what anthropomorphisms are. But the point here is that there's not necessarily a paradox to say that Jesus knew and didn't know at the same time if you're talking about two different natures. Two different natures. Jesus the man needed to learn carpentry. Jesus the man needed to learn to speak Aramaic. Jesus the child needed to learn how to walk. This is true. Jesus the man did not know the date of his final return. That's what you see in Mark 13. And yet, his divine mind was not so limited. His divine mind was not limited in any such way. And at certain times, at certain intervals throughout his ministry, the knowledge of the divine nature was communicated to and through his humanity. We know this to be so. And think about the Samaritan, the woman at the well that he meets. She's amazed and astonished. Why? Because this man knew everything I ever did. He knew the relationships and the things and the experiences she'd had in the past. Remember when Jesus, he's walking through a crowd. Someone touches the hem of his garment. He stopped and said, someone touched me. And he knew in that moment that his power had gone out. There is a sense in which Jesus' divine knowledge, when he prophesied about the fall of Jerusalem and the like, there is a sense in which that was communicated to and through his humanity. How and why and when and so forth? That we need to stop short. How all these things were communicated, we don't know. And we don't know exactly what was communicated and when. We do believe the Holy Spirit played a role in this. But we're wise if we just kind of state what we do know and then step back. Again, there's a reason why Paul called all this the mystery of godliness. And he says specifically with regards to God taking on human flesh. There's a reason why Isaiah wrote that God had said, my ways are not your ways and my thoughts are not your thoughts. We're not going to wrap our minds around this. If you're hoping this would be the sermon to do it, you have to listen to, I guess, a better preacher, because it ain't going to happen here. We do not have the ability to process or understand this in its fullness. And yet we do know what Luke 2 explicitly says, that as a child, Jesus increased in wisdom. We know that to be true every bit as we know that he's all-knowing. These two things, seemingly at odds, are not so. The more you understand two different natures in one person. Now, again, there's a lot more to this, and we'll unpack some of this in sermons yet to come. But this passage, remember I said at the outset, this is a tough one to work through? This passage about a child Jesus, ironically causes us to have to stretch our theological wings, maybe more so than some of the passages later on. it'll be easier. When we talk about turning water into wine, I guarantee you that'll be more straightforward than this, believe it or not. When you're looking at this doctrine, it's like you're looking at this tall, majestic mountain. And the further up you look, you see that there's this fog and mist surrounding the higher aspects of the peak to the degree that you can't even see the top. Some doctrines work that way. You can see the base and you can see how majestic and large this thing is. But the further up you look and try to understand, there are mists and mysteries therein. And trying to understand the peak or even assess the peak sometimes is impossible. I think that is true with a great deal of theology, and it's definitely true of this. It's definitely true of the incarnation. Nevertheless, it is worth taking the time to sit as we have sat, to study, to think these things through. If we have questions afterwards, we should do so. And when we do so, we're doing the same thing that Jesus did. We're in good company because we're sitting, we're hearing the words of God. We're seeking out answers, asking questions as appropriate, and seeking out the presence of our Father through the words that we study. Let me pray for us.
This has been a sermon by Pastor Toby Holt of Christ Presbyterian Church in Marietta, Georgia. If you would like to hear other sermons by Pastor Holt, please visit our website at www.christpca.org, or you can find us on sermonaudio.com.